Welcome to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's research podcast series, Paths to On-Farm Excellence, where we discuss priority topics for Canadian dairy farmers. My name's Stephen Roach. I'm an epidemiologist with a passion for dairy cattle health and welfare. I did my master's and PhD trying to understand how farmers, their staff, and their advisors can work together as a team to improve. And I'm part of a team that's working with the Dairy Farmers of Canada to help showcase the latest in dairy research for Canadian dairy farmers, advisors, and their supply chain. You'll find this channel features a number of different series, from animal care to biosecurity to research summaries and beyond. This podcast series features conversations with farmers, veterinarians, nutritionists, hoof trimmers, and other farm advisors, researchers, and many other industry stakeholders. Our goal is really to provide farmers and their advisors with useful information that can be applied back home on the farm. If you like the content here, don't forget to subscribe to our feed and tell your friends. We've perhaps never before been as focused as we are in today's dairy industry in pursuing a better understanding of genetics and genomics to tackle modern-day problems. Of course, we've long employed our understanding of genetics in the industry to select for desirable traits, but the continued work from the University of Guelph, for example, seeks to improve health, welfare, and productivity of farm animals through genetic and genomic selection, as well as uncovering the relationship between phenotype and genotype in livestock. By innovating new methods and using statistical models to mine vast amounts of information, these researchers are pushing the bounds of how we can achieve long-term and sustainable genetic improvement. Today's episode features discussions around the impact of timed AI on genetic evaluations. We're joined by Colin Lynch and Lucas Alcantara. Lucas is the Research Center Data Manager at the University of Guelph and a somewhat recent PhD graduate from the university. Colin is a PhD student in the Center for Genetic Improvement of Livestock. Both Colin and Lucas have worked in the labs of Dr. Christine Bays and Flavio Schenkel, and in collaboration with a number of other researchers, have spent a great deal of time working in the world of animal breeding, genetics, and all things data. So, let's jump in. Okay, Colin, Lucas, really excited to have the chance to sit down with you, chat a little bit more about some of the work you've been involved in, quite a large project that you've both been playing a role in, significant role in, and many others as well as part of Dr. Christine Bays, among others' research. So thanks very much for taking the time to sit down and chat with me today.
Good to be here.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
So we've done a little bit of an intro. I always like to hear from everyone a little bit about their story, how they got into this role, where they're at today. So maybe, Lucas, we'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about yourself. How do you sort of play a part and a role into this story we're going to tell today?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Lucas Alcantara. I was a PhD student under Dr. Flavio Schenkel and Dr. Christine Bays at the University of Guelph. We did a lot of studies together during my animal breeding and genetics program. We started in 2018 and I graduated in 2022. So now I am working as a research center data manager at the University of Guelph, where I work with data that is collected at livestock and crop research centers in Elora, Ponsonby, and Alma, and so on. So it's been an interesting journey to work with livestock at the University of Guelph and being at the cutting edge of animal breeding. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, no doubt. And no short number of challenges is in managing all of those different centers and the data that comes with them. And we'll look forward to getting some insights from you in terms of how you manage some of those things and what you can get out of all that information. Really excited to have you here, Lucas. And likewise, Colin, really excited to hear from you. Tell me about yourself.
Yeah, so originally from Ireland. Yeah, Lucas, you never told everyone that you were Brazilian.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm from Brazil, by the way.
So originally from Ireland, I did my undergrad back there in ag science at the University College Dublin. I'm a city kid, so from Dublin as well. So I don't have a huge farming background, but both my parents grew up on farms, so I would have that connection there. Then in 2018, I moved over to Canada and started my master's with Dr. Christine Bays and Dr. Flavio Schenkel as well, like Lucas. And that's kind of where my timed AI and genetic evaluations journey began. And kind of since I finished that master's in 2020, I've stepped into the next role, being the PhD, kind of following in Lucas's footsteps. But yeah, that's kind of the kind of main things going on in my life as of now.
Before we go on, you know, I'll speak for myself anyway, as an epidemiologist, I know enough maybe to be dangerous in a conversation about genetics, but I'm certainly no expert. And I know many of our farmers, many of our farm advisors out there, you know, I'd actually probably call many of them experts at the level they know and understand and work in the world of genetics. But we're going to talk about a few, you know, core principles here around timed AI and some of the principles behind some of that work. And so just to sort of set the record straight and make sure we can bring everyone along with this conversation, I want to just ask a couple of just what might be basic questions, but I think helpful for all of us to be on the same page. One notably, I think, is worth talking right off the top here, Colin, is around the difference and sort of the linkage between phenotype and genotype and the relationship in livestock. So why do we care about these two things? What do they mean? How do they interrelate?
To take the famous words from Mike Coffey over in Roslyn, from a genetics point of view, and it was forgotten for a little period of time, phenotype will always be king. We're always interested in collecting these really highly accurate phenotypes that will be funneled into our genetic evaluation so that we can, yes, as we look at the base kind of formula for us as geneticists, phenotype equals our genotype plus our environment. And what we're interested in is, yeah, we can get those high quality phenotypes with high accuracy that we can correct for the known environmental variances that are going on there so that we can accurately predict essentially which animals are of the highest genetic merit to then select generation through generation.
And is it fair to say then, so the phenotype ultimately is what we can see, what we can observe, what we're essentially looking at or after, I guess, in the sense of actually selection. And then the phenotype equals genotype. So that's obviously the DNA, the structure, the genes within an animal. And then the environment is the key piece in terms of what may turn on or off or select for certain phenotypes.
That's basically it. I always like to break it down as, yeah, phenotype, you got that pH, that physical record when it's starting with that pH. It's that actual thing that we can see, that we can record. The genotype, yeah, we truly can't see it from just looking at an animal. But yeah, by understanding, okay, what was that animal exposed to in life, we can kind of make corrections on that phenotype. So we're really chipping away at that phenotype to get down to, okay, what at a genetic level is this animal showing us?
Great. And Lucas, on your side, I know you've dug a lot into what I think is a very exciting world in terms of how we deal with huge volumes of data and come out with important insights that, you know, any one person may struggle to get, or in other words, we could optimize and gain efficiencies by using things like machine learning. And in our world today, I feel like we're hearing much more about machine learning in all sorts of walks of life. Talk to us about what it is. Break that down for us. What's machine learning? Why is it applicable to this kind of story?
Yeah, so I think what is interesting in this case is geneticists, when they are doing their genetic evaluations, they have their models and they do a lot of research and they know exactly which of the variables, which of the components will play a role into expressing that phenotype. So they have the models very well defined, you know, everything that plays a role, and they can evaluate that. But sometimes we don't know exactly what those components are. Sometimes we are working with a very large data set that we cannot, our human minds cannot figure out what are the variables that will play a role into that phenotype, that characteristics. So with machine learning, what it helps with is that it will use some sort of algorithms, computer languages, that it will look at the data structure and it will learn from the data. So you don't necessarily have to know what the variables are to come up with your results, but it will learn itself with the data and then it will give you the result. So it learned the patterns in the data for you, thus it gives you more accurate results most of the cases. So there's a lot of tweaking, a lot of finicking, if put in simple words, with the models so that you can get better results. But you don't necessarily have to know exactly which of the parameters that you put in your model to make it work. So with that, you can expand a lot and you can work a lot without necessarily having to know everything before you start modeling.
Yeah, and no doubt hugely needed given the volume and just amount of data that we're talking about these days and trying to come up with, not just, I get to use the word insights or results here, but also to find reliable insights that we can use, you know, from huge, huge data sets, thousands and thousands of animals, for example, or data points, depending on what we're talking about. So guys, you've been doing, well, we've both in the world of timed AI and its implications, or looking at its implications on genetic evaluation of fertility traits. Tell me a little bit about sort of the problem here. What's sort of the focus of your research, the big question that you've been trying to ask? And to put it bluntly, why should we care about it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's straight to the point. And from our genetics kind of point of view, and we touch on it a lot, is around that phenotype, as I mentioned initially, that the phenotype is really of importance and the accuracy of that phenotype is of importance. And when we use a technology such as timed AI, which I do want to make a kind of a preemptive thing saying, I think timed AI is like a fantastic technology. And I don't think there's any geneticists out here that would want to push not using such a technology as such. But the issue with timed AI, especially from a genetic evaluation point of view for fertility traits, is that we're masking that animal's natural fertility. And when we kind of think about it, if we take a simple trait like calving to first service, as an example, which is included within our indexes as of now, so when that animal calves, when is it serviced again? And that really is a kind of identifier for, okay, after calving, how long does it take for that animal to start cycling again? So a measure of, yeah, how long from point calving to cycling again, okay, she's fertile again, she's able to sustain a calf again. And so when you use things like timed AI, you're artificially controlling that animal's natural hormones so that she starts beginning to cycle again as such. And it's not really a representation of how good she is or how related it is to her natural fertility. So again, we're masking the phenotype. And so the issue is that these mass phenotypes are then being incorporated into our overall genetic evaluations. So a potential issue could be that if you have one particular sire that has a lot of daughters, let's say predominant amount of daughters that are using this timed AI protocols, those mass phenotypes might be artificially inflating that respective bull's breeding value, meaning that he's higher ranked for fertility, where in natural or where in actual reality, he should be further down the list. And that's kind of the real question that we want to look into, want to delve into, is how much are these timed AI records impacting our current genetic evaluations?
Yeah, and then adding on that point, so genetic evaluations in Canada is done automatically by Lactinet. 3 times a year, computer software runs it. There's almost no human interference on that. All the data that comes through DHI goes through the database, vetted, checked, curated, things flow. And then you get your EBVs, your values there, right? But if the breeding method is not decipherable, like if a human has to read and understand if it's timed AI or not, that's not feasible. On our when we looked at the data set on farm data set, around 140 new unique breeding codes were being added every year. So how do you go about that manually? You just can't. So with that challenge, we proposed to write a machine learning model that would learn from all of this breeding descriptions, and it would, with a high performance, tell, okay, this name that the farmer inputted on their software means timed AI. Doesn't matter what it is, it's timed AI or not timed AI. So then we can automatically, on a computer program, separate timed AI or not timed AI, so we can account for that technique when we are doing genetic evaluations. So that was the main drive for my portion of the project.
Yeah, that's great. So it's sort of really helping to refine our understanding and the utility of genetic evaluations. Lucas, maybe can you start off with just telling us a little bit about when you came into starting this work? What were you after? What were some of your goals and objectives? And maybe we can highlight some of the challenges along the way as we segue onto Colin's sort of objectives. And then from there, we can go into some of the results a little bit more.
To answer that, we have to go back all the way to one of our colleagues that worked with us at the time. He was one of the postdocs at the group, Dr. Gerson Oliveira. We all looked at timed AI and we thought, well, that's a management practice. We think that that might play a role into genetics, but does it really do anything? Does it really cause bias into the genetic evaluations or not? And then we always had that question in mind. So Gerson, he started looking into that. And because we didn't have farm data at the time, he did a simulation study, right? And on his work, he would create different scenarios. He would simulate herds that would have different percentage of animals that would go under timed AI. And then he would estimate the effects of having those different percentages. How would that play a role into the genetic evaluation if having more or less animals being under timed AI, if that would change the accuracy or the values of the breeding values for those traits, fertility traits. So he did get results that would indicate, yes, that they would change depending on the amount of timed AI that is being used on a herd and the number of herds that use timed AI across the country. So that was a big moment for us. And then when we finally got farm data, that's when Colin started working on it. So maybe Colin, you want to jump and talk a little bit about yours?
Yeah, so yeah, kind of as Lucas kind of said, that, and this is kind of a mainstay, I would say, with a lot of kind of looking at these kind of novel approaches is that, okay, if there's no immediate available data, let's just try some sort of simulation. We can play around with the different parameters that we have, the different inputs, and really kind of see, okay, is there merit to actually exploring these different things? And yeah, as Lucas said, the different parameters that Gerson looked across, as timed AI essentially increased within his population, we were seeing unfavorable changes in each of these parameters. And just to add them to the discussion, it was essentially like the relationship between the true breeding value and the estimated breeding value, the differences between the rank of these sires that we were looking at, which were really of most interest from a genetics point of view, if we look at how we rank sires and stuff like that. Also, the differences between the means of the top 25, 50, 75, and 100 sires within the population, we could see that as timed AI increased, all these means were shifting towards zero. So that was kind of the initial kind of point where we were at, where, okay, yeah, we have now identified that there is likely an issue going on here. And I think it's also important to point out that Christine was advocating for this for a couple of years. Like she was interested in this topic well before I had arrived in Guelph. But again, there was no data set there that we felt was of interest or was available, sorry, not of interest, that could possibly do a study like this. But through talks with, which was then CanWest DHI and CDN back then, now together as LactinAir, they were able to pull a big data set for me of fertility records. And it was about 4.4 million breeding records from 770,000 cows between 2009 and 2018. So a pretty good substantial size data set for me to analyze. And within that, I had essentially, okay, what herd it was, what animal it was, different characteristics of when the animal calved as such, kind of some of your basic information, some trait information regarding like, oh, calving to first service to conception, days open of that animal from its previous lactation. And then, yeah, the breeding method used, the breeding code associated with that. And then did that animal become pregnant? Did she return open or did she abort in some cases? And so within this then and the way things got complicated even further was these breeding codes that we have were single letter values essentially. So a herd could have any number. They It was open to whatever that herd felt they needed to represent, okay, what approaches they were using. So it could range from A to H, A to Z, whatever. And these were all independent for each individual herd. And so from a genetics point of view, one of these big issues was that there was just a severe lack of consistency across the data. So what I found was, I think, a total of 5,800 breeding codes across each of these 1,100, 1,200 herds. So you can just imagine the amount of variability within that then. And I think in total, roughly about 2,000 of those were completely unique. And so you'd probably think to yourself there that, like, how is there even 2,000 different methods of actually inseminating an animal? It's really not that there is. It's just the fact that there's a lot of ways to say the exact same thing. And my favorite example is to always look at so OVSync, which is kind of the most conventional, the most famous timed AI technique. I had 153 different ways of saying OVSync. And it literally is just because they may drop the H at the end. They may drop a letter here or there. They may put an asterisk in, or they might put a hyphen in. And these all then become a unique, different way of saying the exact same thing. And so my big challenge kind of working from the start was, okay, how am I going to get through or understand this mountain of different ways of saying essentially the exact same thing? And so one of the big advantages of DHI really is the flexibility of DHI. And it's great that producers have the control to put in, okay, breeding codes that they're comfortable with, they know, so they are recording it properly. But again, the biggest disadvantage of DHI is that it's so flexible for people like us who want to be able to interpret that data and actually make inferences from that data to keep it consistent across time. So yeah, that was one of the big main challenges that I was kind of dealing with at the start, which was, yeah, okay, how am I going to classify these as being either timed AI or heat detection, essentially? And so when me as a naive new little master student at the time, not having major experience, kind of went through just like a little pattern recognition to try and kind of piece together, okay, which ones do I think are timed AI, which ones are heat detection, essentially. And I did a decent job on it by when we were actually looking at the distributions for the traits, everything was making sense. With timed AI, we're going to expect a much narrower kind of distribution because it's completely determined by when that producer actually wants to inseminate the animal, for example. Yeah. While with heat detection, the animal themselves is in charge.
Yeah, I remember that at the time Colin was just crazy about it. It was just it was a horrendous task of going through all of those codes, but I remember on our lab meetings we would go through them and check together. Yeah, that this makes sense. This is timed AI. No, this is not timed AI. This is who knows what this is. So we'll just put it as whoever, like whatever it is, right? So I remember those conversations, and then at the end I remember so we got a pretty good confident labeling of those breeding codes. So that was the exciting part, because maybe this is the segue to mine now. So Colin's challenge was where my fun began. So when I look at that problem, I said, wow. So okay, so we now, so let's say that we figure out a way, like, okay, so with farm data, we can say that there is really a potential bias, this re-ranking of bulls. Yeah, we see that on the farm, but how in this world are we going to put an automated pipeline to run genetic evaluations based on if it was timed AI or not? Because nobody's going to read these codes every three times a year to figure out what it is. So that's when I started to say, okay, let's build a machine learning model that can handle that, can be put into a computer system, and that can automatically figure out what's timed AI, what's not timed AI. So we can either maybe split the traits, as Colin suggested at the end of his work, as one of the suggestions, or we could account for the effect of timed AI there. That's how maybe that the story progressed from Jerson to Colin and to me, and how we wrapped it all up.
Colin Lucas, I think that's a really nice explanation, both of the sort of the problem, the big picture problem in the why we care, but also walking us through the sort of the sequence in terms of research projects and questions that, you know, how do we need to first answer this question, then we go to this problem and so on. And so I guess the big question becomes, and for our listeners, probably the focal point is to say, so where have we gotten? What were we able to achieve, and what's the take home message as a result of that? And I assume you'll probably have to tell us a little bit about the how you got there as well, but help paint that picture for us. Maybe Colin, you want to start us off there.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, the how, of course, is extremely important. And the way that my study kind of, or my analysis went about it, was that we had this big massive data set of about 4 million records. And so what I did was I essentially identified animals that had just used timed AI and animals that had just used heat detection. And then between those two respective groups, kind of identified, okay, a common group of bulls that had significant records in both of those groups. And then I conducted an evaluation on both of those separate groups. So in the first evaluation here, we just have timed AI records being used. And in the second evaluation, we just have heat detection being used. And then we ranked the respective sires in both of those groups. So we had, okay, sire number, let's say 242, ranked at position 12 when only timed AI records was using, while he was ranked at 36 when only heat detection records. So we really wanted to see, okay, how do sires change, or do they change at all? So our kind of our overall hypothesis really was that if there was no effect of timed AI on fertility evaluations, we'd expect that wolves rank nearly the exact same, essentially, because we were looking at the exact same traits. While if there was significant re-ranking, that then likely, yes, there is something going on here with those timed AI records that are likely causing a bias in our evaluations as they are set today. And yet the main results of what we've seen was, yes, that is absolutely true. For most traits, the correlation was down at about 0.3 or 0.4, meaning, yes, large re-ranking, that a sire that is good for it, or has a good genetic merit for it, the heat detection traits, doesn't necessarily do well on timed AI, and vice versa. And the real kind of issue here is that the way we define these traits today is really based on, okay, that animal's natural fertility. So when we look at that, it's from that natural heat detection kind of method. So in an evaluation that we're looking at that way, a sire that's being bumped up just from having more heat detection records is likely causing issues when we're looking at it today, and is something that is concerning that we'll want to look at for sure.
Interesting. So Lucas, help. I know you were sort of the next chain in the link, your link in the chain here. So, you know, what does that mean in terms of your the implications from the questions that you asked?
So for my side of the work, what we did was, as we identified that there were around 140 new codes coming every year, we had to deal with those new codes and identify what they would be. So what we wanted to train a model that was robust enough that you would just have it trained and ready to go, and it would be able to predict what were the codes that were coming every year. So we trained these models with different amounts of data. So from the first few years, we trained with only a little, like a small subset of the data, and then we say, okay, is this model able to predict what are timed AI and what's not timed AI on the immediately following year? Now put the data from that year to the training model and forecast the following year. And you keep increasing the data set and seeing the performance of every year. So when we did that, we saw that the models that we built, they were able to precisely predict all of those breeding codes to say if it was timed AI or not, regardless of the amount of data that we used. And that gives us an idea that if I train the model, if I create this model today with data from the beginning, 2007, if I'm not mistaken, until today, that same model will be very accurate for the next 10 years without need to retrain or anything, which is very, very good. And to put into perspective for the audience that might not be familiar with statistics or anything like that, So on a scale from 0 to 1, our model was able to have a score, a performance score of 0.994 to predict that. So that's almost 1, which is amazing. So all of the timed AIs were actually classified as timed AI, and all the ones that we said was timed AI were actually timed AI. So we went through the exercise of going through the wrong labels, whatever. Oh, the model said it was timed AI, but it wasn't. Well, what is it? And then when we looked at it, we were like, ooh, I don't even know what this is. So not even a human could detect what that was, right? And the other way around too. So that gave us a lot of confidence that the models that we built is it's very good. But the way that we did as well, the work we built as a more of a methodological paper that the industry could go through the publication and they can see how it was done and they can build off of that. So let's say AI companies, they do their own genetic evaluations, so they can as well rank their own bulls and see, oh, do my bulls perform better on timed AI or not? Can I target big dairies that do a lot of timed AIs, a lot of timed AI, right? So that is a product that came out of this research that can benefit the industry right there. So the paper is open source. The industry can go and check. And so that would be number one. And number two is for the national genetic evaluation. So that can be tied into the program that we have now. So we can say, yes, if we have to deal with this bias, there is a way that we can automate the process. I think that's the big outcome of our work in that sense.
And yeah, if I could even pump a little air further into Lucas's tires, there was several cases of where Lucas's algorithm predicted something being timed AI or heat detection, where it was coming out as wrong, but it was actually that I had recorded it wrongly. So Lucas's algorithm was far better than my ability to correctly allocate all of these different things. So yeah, it just shows the power and the learning ability that the algorithm did have. And it really does show that, yeah, there is potential to, okay, we can still use, because the easy way out would be, okay, we'll draw a line in the sand here. We'll apply this, what we know now, to, or send it to this information to DHI to encourage farmers to kind of collect this information more consistently somewhere, whereby there might be some sort of drop down list, for example, okay, timed AI or heat detection being used. But then we're essentially saying, okay, well, let's screw that last 13 or so years of data. Well, Lucas's algorithm now allows us to also incorporate that with high accuracy, which is great. So we're already a few steps ahead of the game, essentially.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that as of today, there is zero distinction between the two. Zero, right? So we currently do not account at all for timed AI and heat detection. So if we implement something like what we proposed here, we will be way better with an actual number that can give us confidence that it's accurate. It's not a guesswork, a human guesswork, right? Oh, I think this is timed AI. Maybe not. So we have a high accuracy confidence that's the right one.
Is that the next step then, Lucas? Just thinking, you know, beyond maybe the research projects into adoption and application, is that where you'd hope to see this go to have further impact?
What I would hope to see is to have a study done that would actually perform a genetic evaluation and confirm the bias or not, right? To get all of this and run the genetic evaluation, run the models. The project finished. We didn't come to that part. Colin graduated. Everybody finished. So, but I would like to see that coming off. But you know what? Most of all, what I would love to see is that the industry would standardize that collection, like Colin said, a way that we could flag those codes. We do that for other traits already, like lameness. I think we do that pretty well in Canada. So we could do that for fertility as well. The farmer can keep doing whatever they want, and they should write whatever they want. whatever makes sense to them, but map it on the back end, right? At our level. So we have that level of confidence, but we will always have those that don't really see the need, don't really understand. So I think the next step would also be to reach out to the farmers and say, hey, there is re-ranking of the bulls because of timed AI. So there is a clear need to record this properly, to put effort into actually saying this was timed AI, this was activity, this was, you know, natural, whatever it is, but record it properly. So then we as an industry, we can progress together and improve, right? As the saying said, you cannot improve what you don't measure, right? So I think that's the next step. Raise awareness among farmers for data, accurate data collection. We as an industry, we do an absolutely fantastic job. I'm in awe when I came to Canada and I learned how things are done here. We're like, oh wow, this is paradise for data science. But we still have room for improvement.
Well, I think that's a nice way to end. Is you know, we've helped to paint a picture here where we've improved efficiency, refined things, and shed some light on some important biases here that can be resolved and efficiently. And so now it's a matter of just finding further improvements and opportunities to further refine our understanding and then the application of the insights that come from that work. So I think with that, thank both of you for taking the time to chat with me today. Really exciting work, really interesting results. And thanks so much for what you've done for the industry thus far.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you very much, Stephen.
Thanks for listening to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's research podcast series. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. For more information, please visit dairyfarmersofcanada.ca/en/dairy-research. This podcast was narrated by myself, Stephen Roach, edited and produced by Carly Wright. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The project is part of Dairy Research Cluster 3, a national research funding program made possible by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada's Agri-Science Clusters program, the Dairy Farmers of Canada, Lactinet, and Novalay.